thanks for tuning in again to another episode of the Vigilance Press Podcast. Today I have a panel of gaming and comics luminaries before you. Regular co-host Dan Hauser. Dan, how you doing?
Oh, well. Well, doing well.
Excellent. Mr. Chris McLaughlin, who has written, boy, a half dozen or dozen Green Ronin Mutants and Masterminds releases and is currently working on the Emerald City source book. How you doing, Mr. McLaughlin?
Oh, feeling fine, sir. How are you?
All right. Great to have you back. And last but not least, we have Dr. Comics. That's you can find his blog at drcomics.blogspot.com. And that is Jason Tondreau. How you doing tonight, sir?
I'm awesome. Thanks.
Great, great. Well, hey, first on the agenda, Chris, can you tell us anything at all about Emerald City Sourcebook?
Emerald City Sourcebook. Well, it's going to be awesome. In my humble.
How awesome?
Super awesome? Really, we have been waving the osmometer over it, and seriously, we've broken the thing a couple of times.
I think I saw one of those at the Church of Scientology I went to, but go on.
You're going to make us sound like scam artists, sir.
I haven't kept up with a lot of the third edition M&M stuff. So how is Emerald City different than Freedom City?
Well, in real world terms, it was designed from a very, very, very different paradigm.
Yeah.
Because Freedom City is sort of if you were able to pick Steve Kinson and shake him up, not that I would advise that because we love Steve.
Right.
Steve, as we say down south, Steve's a big old boy. Steve would take care of himself. But you know, beyond that, beyond the logistical difficulties of shaking Steve Kinson, and you were to gently pour out all the things that he's loved from his lifetime of comics, that would be Freedom City.
And it was very obvious in reading Freedom City that it was very much a labor of love and a tribute to all of Steve's favorite C-list characters that he thought deserved more credit. You know?
Yes. Yes. Well, Emerald City was built from the ground up as sort of the sum total of the feedback that we've gotten from our audience over the nearly decade that we've been doing Mutants and Masterminds.
Yeah.
So it's built a lot more from the perspective of, you know, there aren't already established superheroes. You know, it's very much designed where your group are going to be the heroes. Everything is on their responsibility. It's a city that's frankly not used to having superheroes in it.
Okay, so you don't have a situation where there were superheroes, but they've all vanished for some reason before the players show up.
Well, we talk about some past heroes that, you know, weren't around for very long, didn't make much of an impression.
Yep.
But, you know, the player characters are going to be the first big-time heroes that have been there. The first, you know, guys that you have on speed dial to save the world. They're going to be the first caliber heroes like that.
Got it.
So very, very, very much aimed toward the player characters. And it's also got a fair amount of mystery built into it. Not to say that Freedom City doesn't.
Right.
But, you know, Freedom City has had superheroes. I think by the time we were done, we'd traced them all the way back to the Revolution.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, nothing like that in Emerald City. It's a town that's still adjusting to the notion. So it's got a little bit of that, just a little bit of that Ultimates kind of heroes type flavor of people adjusting to the notion of having people flying over their city without, you know, mechanical aid. I guess we're all used to planes and stuff, from the South. I don't know. That's a dodgy proposition.
They're
flying metal air trucks down here.
Yeah.
So.
The reason why I like that is because it opens up a whole new kind of story to tell.
Yes.
That you can't tell in Freedom City. Freedom City is like Astro City. Like, everybody's so used to superheroes being there that the whole fabric of the city has changed to incorporate superheroes. And what you want to do, what we can do in Emerald City, is tell a whole different kind of story, to tell that kind of look up in the sky, is it a bird, is it a plane kind of story.
Very much so, very much so.
Is that right?
In fact, you know, it kind of, like I said, we're still working on the actual final results of it, but kind of the attitude that I tried to put into my bit of the first draft was, it was a town that's kind of like, oh, so you're a superhero, how nice for you, how very nice for you. You know, it's not that they don't appreciate being saved or anything like that. It's just it's not, you know, not quite what you have in Freedom City.
Now, there was a great scene when Grant Morrison was writing JLA, which was my favorite arc in recent memory on JLA, where, you know, someone's stomping the city and JLA shows up and saves it. And once they're doing the cleanup, some guy walks up to Green Lantern, who at the time was Kyle Rayner, and he's like, hey, what's so special about you? I could do better with that ring. What's wrong with you?
That is, if I believe it right, JLA number 11. No, JLA 8. It's in JLA 8.
That is why he is Dr. Comics later, ladies and gentlemen.
I only know this because, and I shit you not, can I say that?
No, go ahead, fine, yeah.
No,
I actually used that exact scene in my book that comes out later this year.
Which one?
That scene where the Green Lantern is there.
Not which scene, which book?
Oh, my book. Oh, it's coming out in many months. I don't want to steal from Chris. We can matter for another podcast, gentlemen. But it's called was it the Round Table? Comics Connections to Medieval and Renaissance Literature.
Oh.
And it's coming out Farland Publishers, which is an academic press. So which means I won't get paid anything for it. But my point is that I know exactly the scene you're talking about, and it's funny that you should bring it up because that's exactly what I was thinking about as Chris was telling us about this scene. Yeah, Green Lantern and the rest of the Justice League fight these like evil clones of themselves that have been created with Lex Luthor's, you know, super MacGuffin of the day. And after it's all over, this guy comes up and's like, well, you know, you guys don't think about all the wreckage that's left after you're gone. He says, you're like, whoosh, off to the moon. And our lives are forever changed and shattered in many ways by this sort of wreckage that you've left behind. And Green Lantern, who was Kyle at the time, is trying to debate with him. He's like, hey, well, you know, listen, mister, I'm just doing my best, you know. And Superman grabs him and says, we don't really have time for this, mister, and you'll have to excuse us. And off they go. But that scene is a callback to the classic Hal Jordan scene, right, where he's in the first issues of the
– Brave and the Bold?
The Hard Traveling Heroes books, you know, with Green Arrow, Green Lantern, where the
you help people with purple skin and green skin.
Exactly, that's Kyle Jordan's,
Kyle Rayner.
That's Kyle Rayner's Black Skins moment, where the guy comes up and says, "You know, you've helped the purple skins and the orange skins, but what have you ever done for the black skins?" And that's the scene that Morrison is referencing when he makes that moment. And what's great about what Chris is talking about is that we can do all those scenes in Emerald City. And we can't really do them in Freedom City because everybody loves superheroes in Freedom City.
Not to mention Dr. Metropolis makes sure that that stuff really doesn't happen in Freedom City. Oh, no, the building fell down. And then 3 days later, the building's somehow going back up.
I certainly don't want to give the impression that people in Emerald City hate superheroes. Not from that. It's just a question of they're still trying to grasp the idea. They're still trying to figure out how exactly they react to it.
And I'm not mistaken in believing that Freedom City also has links to Freeport. They kind of wanted to link it to that medieval setting as well. I think that's great, by the way. I think that's a really cool idea. Because I have actually set characters from my Supers game into a high fantasy world instead of Freedom City that was Freeport.
Well, the obvious thing that's going to happen is that players who have only played fantasy games are going to sit down in the GM's room and they're going to say, well, I don't like superheroes. Superheroes are dumb. And so then the GM can say, well, then just make your dwarf. And the dwarf gets popped into Freedom City from Freeport and he's good to go.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how that works.
So, Chris, can you give us any sneak peeks, previews, tantalizing tidbits about what we're going to see in Impel City?
Wow. I can tell you some general things. Like, you know, we give you a little bit about the historical background of it, and it's without giving away too much. It's an area where weird things have been happening over the years. Yeah. But like I said, the lack of superheroes, nobody's quite put together the dots that there's a pattern, that there's actually more going on in this city than anyone really, really figures out on. And, you know, it's in the Pacific Northwest, so there's, I mean, a lot of folklore and stuff in there to tie into. And
Is it in the Portland, Seattle area, kind of?
We just sort of leave it vaguely in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
And, you know, we tried to incorporate as much of the culture and the geography of that area as we could. And, you know, still being quite coy about exactly where it is.
Yeah, sure.
You know, one of the things I got to write was the sports section. And, you know, I tried to put in as many like regional rivalries as possible, you know, like when the Emerald City football team, I put them in the same division as the Seattle Seahawks. So that's like their like life and death rival. So, you know, things like that.
They are the Emerald City Munchkins, aren't they?
Ow.
Well,
ow.
Okay. Well, again, it may or may not make the final draft, but that's actually a derisive nickname for one of the local teams that the local fans are quite frustrated with.
I approve.
Yes, there is literally no team named the Munchkins, but you know that's just, you know, anytime somebody has a losing season, that's what they get stuck with.
Flying monkeys.
At least not in my section. I don't know. That may be a delight that only Kinson can indulge in. I don't know.
If you name the place Emerald City, you have got to do the Oz riffs. I mean, it's a huge target. Oh well.
Well, if you've picked up the absolutely free first chapter of Emerald City Nights,
yeah.
One thing that we've already addressed is the fact that people in the city either love that or love the tie-in or hate it. There are a lot of local merchants that, you know, will sell, I think like the big shopping district is Yellow Brick Row.
Right.
And then there are other people in town that you know, you start singing that Follow Yellow Brick Road song and they'll punch you right in the face. And a cop will just stand there and watch.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, the city's ambivalence toward the whole L. Frank Baum connection, that's something we've already addressed.
Good.
And we tried not to ride that horse to death in the source book. Okay. So it's there, but we don't beat it to death.
I wanted to say, Chris, that this idea of kind of like the mysterious plot that's been going on for a long time and that no one has ever sort of connected the dots. That's great for campaigns. I mean, that's like ready made for the new GM, right? Who's starting a new third edition Mutants and Masterminds campaign, and you know, he doesn't know what he wants to do, or maybe he even has a supervillain that he wants to use, but he doesn't really have a plot. Now he can take what you guys have done and either use it wholesale or make it fit to the villain he already wants to use. I mean, that's just very thoughtful and considerate. That's exactly the kind of stuff that I, as a GM, love to buy.
Oh, well, very much so. I mean, one of the things that we definitely tried to do on here was to try to make every single aspect of this something that you could take with and run in your game. Like, for instance, I was actually even able to take, like, the local sports scene and tie that back into superheroics.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, you get a bit of background on, you know, like the local sports teams. But, you know, there's also sort of a superhero, supervillainy thing in there that, again, nobody's yet figured out. But now that you're the new superheroes in town – and it's sort of, you know, that's one of the things direction you can send your campaign in.
You know, it's funny because it's good to hear all that because superheroes and sports have a long and inglorious connection, right? All of these awful superhero comic books based on sports.
Oh, NFL Super Pro,
don't you?
Dare we raise the specter of NFL Super Pro?
Yes, or Kickers Inc.
Oh, our Marvel's WCW comic.
Oh, yes. But then at the same time, though, think of all those wonderful stories that we've read of, like, the superheroes that play baseball against each other, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or, I mean, those are as American as apple pie, those stories. We were talking in my class this week. We were talking in class this week about the sort of way that we look at superheroes and the way that different writers have tried to portray superheroes as a metaphor for something in our society. Like, but other people do this superheroes as sports figures. And I've always thought it was a better metaphor because it's a team sport. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you get a bunch of characters together in the Avengers, the JLA, and they have to work together to succeed in a way that a sports team does. Mm. But we haven't gotten too many successful comics that have really played that up. They've all been pretty terrible.
I will say that the meta story of Aberrant, the White Wolf's game.
Oh yes.
Did that very well at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Also the recent comic Supreme Power.
Yeah.
Their version of what's his name? The Flash character. He's really good too, once he becomes famous and starts representing himself like a I would say like a sports celebrity, you know, like The Rock or like was that Michael Jordan was in the 80s and early 90s.
Supreme Power, was that a Jam Straczynski book?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, okay. All right, I know the one.
Yeah, it was a takeoff of Squadron Supreme.
Yep.
It was a retelling of a Romana Clef of the JLA.
Yeah, I read a few issues. I didn't read the whole series.
It was an interesting take. Although now I see where Irredeemable is coming from and Invincible. Like I see the seeds planted for those books to kind of take a piece of that and run with it.
Well, I like it. Now, I like Invincible a lot.
Invincible's great.
I just picked it up this week, actually.
Yeah.
I was really impressed.
Yeah.
Which one?
Irredeemable and Invincible. I'm trying to put together an interview with someone from Boom Studios, so I figured I needed to educate myself. So I picked up that and Soldier Zero and Traveler, just to.
I'm a huge fan of Irredeemable. I
appreciate kind of what's going on in Irredeemable, but I have to say I never need to read another evil Superman story in my life. You know, there's just.
I think that because he is so close to Superman, it's an evil Superman story.
Yeah.
I mean, the character's powers are Superman.
Yeah.
But the story itself tells me it gives me a better idea of why Superman would ever go evil or what we would consider to be evil.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it does have to be kind of a pressure beyond means to know that you fail every single day.
Right.
That's one of the most brilliant scenes is the evil Superman in this case has, I believe it's Thailand. He's on Thailand and he says, okay, the good guys are there and they all have these portals and they're ushering people through to help them escape.
Yep.
And he says, okay, well, here's what you're going to do. You're going to stop doing that. I'm going to kill everybody. Now you're going to pick five people. And that's how I feel every day. And I was like, you know, I can't imagine how Superman feels, you know, like that's a perfect metaphor for the bad part about being Superman is, you do fail every single day because you can't save everyone.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I don't know
that would push me over the edge, but
my reluctance to read Irredeemable is the same reason why I don't watch Dexter. You know,
really?
I just don't want to spend an hour of my day reading about an asshole.
And Dexter is a different case altogether, I would say.
Not to me. Not to me. But I understand, you know, what I understand what you're getting at.
Well, you know, there's a companion book to that, Incorruptible. I think, you know, it's you know, that's evil Superman's, you know, previous biggest villain who decides to turn into a hero in response to, you know, his an enemy going south. That's a great read.
Yeah. I haven't read it yet. I don't know it yet. Uh-oh. I mean, one of my students, I think, wants to do a paper on it, but I haven't read it yet.
So, well, anyway, what do you think, Chris? You got an opinion on that stuff?
Well, you know, in all honesty, I respect what he's trying to do. I respect anybody that's trying to take comics in a different direction. But
for
my own little space of it, with what little money and what little bit of time I have to spend on comics these days, I want to be eight again. I'm reading a lot of 70s Marvel's reprints.
Yep.
You know, I just got finished with Jack Kirby's 70s run on Captain America.
Oh yeah, they did a compendium of that, didn't they? Then omnibus.
That's coming out. I'm a poor public employee. I'm stuck with the black and white reprints.
Okay.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but
no. You know, and you could probably BitTorrent them for free too if you wanted to.
Well, if I were so inclined, but you know, being a public employee, could not in a public forum acknowledge to engaging in such highly illegal behavior.
Exactly. And as an artist, how dare you? Suggest anyone BitTorrent these people's hard work.
Hire CS around kids. Also eat your vegetables.
Yarr!
Teaching in a state where I have a morals clause in my contract, you know.
Whoa. actually, I wanted to, and I hate to be a jerk, but I'm not positive. I think Incorruptible is that the one with the bad guy, or is it the one with the kid who?
That's the one with the bad guy.
Okay.
It's basically. Lex Luthor sees Superman go bad and decides, all right, I've got to fill that void, and steps up and, you know, becomes the best hero he can be.
Hmm. I haven't read that one yet. I will definitely have to read that one. It will definitely be a palate washer compared to Irredeemable.
So Chris, go on. What else are you reading? You said this Kirby Captain America, and what else?
I read DC, but in all honesty, I'm the DC stuff I'm reading today is just out of habit, and mostly I think out of being in too much physical and emotional shock to turn away from the horror, you know, just to seeing what they're doing. I mean, all right, okay, if I can go off of my own current favorite tangent, okay. You know, the thing that has that I've loved in comics above all else, even when I only got to see them in their summer team ups, were the Justice Society.
Ah.
You know, I adore those Golden Age characters.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, DC, you know, they changed writers on Justice Society, and they go out and hire a guy who says it's time to get them away from this notion of legacy and history and heritage.
It's time to
no.
It's time to burn the masthead of this paper and decide to become a tabloid.
Exactly. I mean, it'd be like getting a Captain America writer saying like, "Well, the first thing we need to do is to move him to make him, you know, Captain Kazakhstan." No.
Right.
No. No, you know, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, it's, I want to go and find where Mark Guggenheim lives. I mean, I don't want him, I don't want to burn his house down. I don't want to hurt his children. I just want to go, please, sir, stop. Just stop. I beg of you, just please stop.
It wasn't broken when it was given to you.
Yes.
So don't break it for the people that come later.
Yes, I mean it's just jaw-droppingly awful. It's nothing anyone wants to read or should want to read.
Oof.
And yeah, I mean it's honestly quickly rivaling Zero Hour for the and the Joe Kelly run on JLA for the worst comics I've ever actually paid money for.
But I
can't stop buying it because, I mean, you know, I love those characters so much.
Yes.
It's like, you know,
yes.
You know, no one wants to see a child tortured, but, you know, you kind of feel like they're your kids. You feel like you ought to do something. You can't turn away.
I'm
at that level of horror and disgust with it. And unfortunately, that's kind of where I am on just about everything DC publishes these days.
You know, I can't tell you how many Avengers issues I've read where I was in your shoes. You know, that because Avengers has had some of the greatest comics ever written, and then it has had 50 issue long runs that stank just beyond belief.
Oh,
and you just grind through it. You know, it's just it's a terrible chore, but you read them because you're so attached to the characters.
Yes.
And every issue is a possibility of redemption. You know?
Yes.
You could.
Yes.
The power of comics means that you can retcon anything in six panels. and maybe the next page will do it. You know, it's one more page and we'll have some sort of crisis and we'll erase the last 12 issues from existence.
You know, you guys sound like Cubs fans. I'm just saying.
Wink, yeah. It's the tribe. Loyalty to the tribe.
Well, hey, we can talk about something positive, okay? You know, really, seriously. Have to talk about Gail Simone in Secret Six. The
sure.
thing that keeps me in
comics. It's a great book.
Yes.
Although, you know what, the last issue where they went to hell, didn't dig it so much. But yeah, in general, I really like that book.
Yes, yes. She is Gail Simone is single-handedly keeping the comics industry alive for me.
Really?
Well, Birds of Prey is a great read, too. But yeah, you know, I gotta say, I liked Catman better before he was all grimdark. You know, back when he and I'm forgetting the guy's name now. The sniper,
Deadshot.
Yeah, but he and Deadshot were, you know, bantering. I kind of like that.
Yeah, yeah. That and I mean, his reimagining as kind of a modern day Kazar was really awesome. And then they just said, no, let's make him exactly like Batman, only he's Catman.
Right.
His parents were murdered by the poacher.
I think he killed his own father and then his son. Ah, well, anyway, I'm sorry, Chris. You were talking about Gail Simone saying good things. Let's go back to that.
Oh, well, and there's just some great irony that, you know, like I said, my main thing in comics is to be a nostalgia trip, and the best thing I'm reading is this book that's about unapologetically horrible people.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that, you know, she doesn't water down the fact that they're villains.
Yeah.
There's just something incongruous about that, but I mean, maybe it's just a testament to what a great writer she is that she can take this premise that's just so far out of my wheelhouse, and it's the first thing I read every single month when I get comics.
You know, the funny thing is, though, is that these books about villains, they often are sort of closet hits. I mean, back in the 70s, Marvel did a supervillain team-up with Doctor Doom and Prince and Namor and stuff, and that book sold fairly solid for Marvel.
Really?
For a good while, yeah. Yeah,
because I've got the complete collection, and there's maybe a half, there's maybe 12, 13 issues of that.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it was doing okay. You know, for Marvel, they could experiment, but then, what would you think of it? Did you like it?
It's one of those books that, unfortunately, once they figure out what you could do with it, and you know what it could be, they canceled it.
Yeah,
the last story arc with Dr. Doom and Magneto is great.
Yeah.
But everything up till that point is just, you know, it's a different writer, it's a different editor, it's a different artist, and it's just, it doesn't gel to the end, and by then it's canceled.
Yeah, it definitely needed, well, see, of course, in today's market, somebody would assign a regular writer and artist to it, and it would stay stable for at least 6 or 8 months. But yeah, you're right. Back then, it was like, okay, well, we've got an artist who's got nothing to do. Let's put him on Supervillain Team Up.
Mm. Oh. Oh, and as a note, the superhero book that I was mentioning, the one with the Superman type characters, called Superior.
Yeah,
it's one of Mark Millar's books.
Yeah,
Recently he's been famous for like Kick-Ass and like these more realistic yet completely like negative. I call them negative books.
Yeah,
I was a fan of Kick-Ass. I really do like that book, and Kick-Ass 2 has been really cool.
Yeah.
Like it's been shockingly almost true to life as far as some of the stuff going on in Seattle is.
Sure.
But Superior is one of those uplifting stories that you hardly get in comics anymore at all.
Yeah. Neat.
About a kid who has CP, who makes a wish that he could walk again, but he ends up being Superman instead.
Mm.
In a world where Superman does not exist. And there is a movie star who is Superman throughout all these Superman-type movies.
Yeah.
And so they think it's this movie star who's doing all these amazing things at first.
Mm.
And so it's a whole thing about how, he's the one guy with superpowers on the planet. It's had like 4 or 5 issues already, 6 maybe.
Yeah.
It's a really good read. Really good read.
Hey, you know, if we're talking about books that we love right now, Atomic Robo.
That is awesome.
It's great fun. It's kind of got the lighthearted, I don't know if you want to call it Silver Age, but it's a more lighthearted feel. And I'm picking up the trades right now. What's the name of that? I think they're Red 5 is the company. But yeah, if you can pick up the back issues of that, that's just a great read. It's fun. It's smart. It's whimsical. References Tesla a lot, so that's a good thing.
Right.
So, hey, Chris, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Of all the books you've written for Green Ronin, and well, how many are we talking now? A dozen?
Oh, my goodness. It's been a lot.
Is there anyone in particular stands out, something you're proud of that was a particular accomplishment, or is it always the latest? What?
I said El Bolo. He is my favorite villain of all time. And,
well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I've told you that before, and I will tell you again. El Bolo still stands out as my group's favorite villain to face. Well, and I've had him make return visits because he's so ridiculous. But each time his focus is not, okay, I've got to beat the powers of these guys. His focus is different bolos would make this better. This one time he had a jet that was a bolo. But then he realizes how awful it is to be in a ball with centripetal force, pushing him back against it, flying through the air. Because he's not like Iron Man. He's El Bolo.
But, you know, in comic book physics, that should work perfectly. There should be no complaints about being whirled around like that.
It was basically I had Toy Boy be the villain. But El Bolo is usually the catalyst for another villain's evil schemes.
Well, if Chris, can you think of a favorite? I have a question for you, but I can save it.
Yeah, I will always, always, always treasure Time of Vengeance. Simply because it's, and I don't want to sound like I'm bragging about this at all, but it's just I've had occasion to go back and revisit it, and it just seems like something so good. I can't believe I had anything to do with it. It's just so much better than I typically think of my writing ability, because when you write an RPG adventure, you have to put in such a level of genericness into it. You have to make it to where it's adaptable to so many different possible situations. And within that sort of built-in compromise, I just there's a couple of moments in there where I go, wow, you know, this, I mean, this feels like a real character. This feels like some, this feels like a little more real type person than you get in a lot of adventures, you know, because to me, the main character, the Death Angel, you know, her plight and her situation really, 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 really got to me. You know, and it's amazing how this is something that I seem to have created at some point, and yet, you know, I can look at it as an outsider and go, wow, that, you know, there's a little bit of pathos and poignancy in there.
Yeah.
And the older I get, the more I appreciate every, you know, the one, our one big breakout hit character in there, a retired B themed supervillain. Who's just sort of, you know, he's stuck in this retirement home doing like villain autograph shows and selling merchandise over the internet. And, you know, and he's just, I mean, he can actually be a key thing in the adventure. But, you know, the fact that, you know, he's just desperate. You know, he doesn't care that you're superheroes. He's just glad that you're there to talk to him.
Yeah.
You know, to me, that's something that's very real. And like I said, I sound like I'm bragging about myself, but it's really just more awe that, like, wow, this is a great adventure, and it seems to have my name on it.
Can I ask you a question about noir?
Absolutely. Oh, can I disavow having anything to do with it?
No? You don't like noir?
Noir was a good book, Chris.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think everybody who likes that book may be on this call right now.
Now, wait a minute. What? Okay, now I guess I'm out of the loop here.
Chris, that book actually sold pretty well, didn't it?
Well, it did, but in all honesty, I don't know how much you could separate that from the fact that it came out where, you know, we could have, like, gone down to the photocopier and just ran off, you know, otherwise blank sheets of paper with the M&M logo on it and probably could have sold out on that. Well, okay. But, you know, and in a way, I looking back, I think that may have been the worst thing that happened to the book, because I think that, you know, that should have been the book that only sold, like, half of its print run. Because I think if like 500 people would have seen it, 500 people would have seen it and gotten it and said, hey, you know, that's kind of neat for the experiment that it was. The fact that it came out when Eminem was, you know, it was just, I mean, not, it's still a terrific seller. I don't want to make it sound like I'm burying Green Ronin or anything. But just, you know, it was the first product that had come out in a while. People bought it up just because it was M&M, and it was something really, really different from what they were expecting. Yeah. And goodness knows, there is probably somebody on RPGNet right now as we speak posting a bashing review of it, of this first edition book that came out 7 years ago. In fact, you know, what really broke my heart was, you know, going to RPGNet and, like, tapping onto threads where people would be talking about, you know, like, Vampire. And in the middle of a Vampire thread, somebody would go like, hey, did you get that noir book for Eminem? Man, did that suck. You know, people would just go off on tangents to talk about how much they hated my book. And that really, you know, that brought me to tears on more than one occasion. I know I'm supposed to have like a thicker skin being in this industry, but just the reaction to noir broke me like three or four times. I just wanted to go home and curl up in the fetal position and cry and not be a gay writer no more.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, because I loved the book.
Well, God bless you, sir. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Let me ask you a question about it, because
sure,
because I'm it's not about the book necessarily, but rather about noir as a genre.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So I'm trying to explain and trying to figure out for myself sometimes the difference between noir and pulp.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a little column in there, like, why noir isn't pulp.
Yes.
And so, but, you know, I'm a hands-on guy. I need an example.
Okay.
So I thought I would try a thought experiment with you and see if you could help me out.
Okay.
What if in Raiders of the Lost Ark was remade as a noir picture?
Oh, wow.
How would it be different?
All right. Well, you know, there's a lot of different riffs that you could put on it. Like, first of all, you absolutely have to lose like the one thing that everybody loves about one thing I think people love about Raiders is that you have that black and white morality. He bring, you know, Lucas and Spielberg bring in the ultimate movie villains, the Nazis.
The Nazis.
Well, you know, you probably have to do sort of a pickup on South Street thing where there's essentially no real difference between the lengths that the Nazis are willing to go to and the lengths that the democracies are supposed to be to. So you'd probably have to do some things to show the American government are at least as bad as the Nazis.
What if they were like Charles Lindbergh's sort of American proto-Nazis?
Then you'd be the Rocketeer, wouldn't you?
Oh, I guess. Well, anyway, go on. All right, so go on. So the American government would have to be shown that they were willing to go to any lengths.
Yeah, that's one riff that you put on. I mean, you absolutely could not do it in that black and white morality that Raider.
I would also think that Indiana Jones goes to the rocket launcher a lot quicker in that film.
Let me ask you a question. I mean,
like hostage taking, and like I think he does a lot more of that.
Maybe, right, possibly. Away. You know,
finger breaking.
There is sort of a narrative thread in a lot of noir movies where your central character is the only person in the world that won't stoop to that ends. You know, you think like the Humphrey Bogart's great noirs.
Yeah.
You know, in Maltese Falcon, Sam Spade goes out of his way not to ever carry a gun.
Right.
I was about to bring up Casablanca, because if you think about it, I mean, the Bogart character in that isn't terribly different from Harrison Ford's character in Raiders.
Yeah, Rick's a jerk for the first hour and a half of that movie, but then suddenly in the last 10 minutes he turns into the only good character.
Well, you get flashes that he's a good guy before that.
Yeah, he was a good guy, but he's been sort of ruined. You know, he's wreckage after the breakup.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, please go on.
You'd have to have Marion Ravenswood. I mean, she could be a strong, independent woman, but she'd also have to be completely and utterly manipulative of Indiana mm-hmm. Jones. She'd have to spurn him at the end. And in fact, in all honesty, I found out recently that in the original version of the movie, Marion disappears from long before the end of the film. It was actually George Lucas's first wife that actually said, you know, your whole audience is going to be wondering what happened to Marion. She's the one who had to point out that you kind of need to put her in the end for the audience's sake.
Yep.
But I think he would have had something closer to their original vision where, you know, she's just out to screw Indy and she's out long, you know, that would be the finale of the picture is that she leaves Indy broken and a complete wreck as she makes off with the Ark and completely screws him over.
Nice. Okay. All right. Now it's a different movie. Okay.
Yes. Yes. And nobody wants to see it. You know, unless you make it about 10, 15 years before you did. But, you know, there's no way.
The dame that stole the radio for talking to God.
Yeah. There's no way you get away with that in a post-Star Wars movie universe.
Right.
Wasn't Lucas's first wife the one who did a rewrite on the Star Wars script and made it, well, not suck?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some debate about exactly what she did, because, you know, she's sort of gone the way of a Soviet agricultural minister as far as like official Lucasfilm history is concerned. But yeah. Apparently, Marcia Lucas.
Siberia, you mean?
Well, you know, she's been airbrushed out all the photos, and apparently
really?
Not
allowed. And I had a job right out of college at the Department of Defense, so I had a lot of free time, and I spent it reading old drafts of Star Wars on the internet, old movie scripts, and it was a temp job. It was okay, but no, it was they were just terrible. A lot of these early drafts were just awful, and when I saw the prequels, I was like, oh, okay, this is George writing on his own right here. Okay,
yeah.
That's what those scripts reminded me of.
What are you trying to say?
This is George after he's lost all his Joseph Campbell books.
Hey, whoa, yeah. Easy.
All right, I love how
Jar Jar was a bit of a misstep, but you have to admit, pod race is pretty cool, and lightsabers.
I love how Dan's George Lucas sounds a little bit like Kermit.
Yeah.
No, Kermit sounds a little bit like George Lucas, okay?
And by extension, sounds a little bit like John Lighthouser.
And Yoda.
Oh. And everybody loves Raymond.
And number 24 from Venture Brothers.
Indeed.
Yeah, I love Venture Brothers. I wish we could get that license. I'd love to do a Venture Brothers licensed RPG.
Dude, I would love to draw that. But then again, there you go. You'd probably get awesome archival like art for it, and I would not get offered anything on that. That would suck. But I would love to play a Venture Brothers role-playing game. That would be awesome.
Well, maybe one day. So, Chris.
Yes.
Emerald City Sourcebook, and we've talked about that, I guess, about as in-depth as we can without violating any NDAs or making anyone at Grindorn and mad. What is next after that?
Well, that'd be a question for John, in all honesty. Beyond that, I'm not privy to what's happening. I know that Emerald City is going to be our Gen Con release, and I know that the DC books will be coming out sometime. And we will be finishing up the remaining chapters of Emerald City Knights, and beyond that, and we will keep putting out the threat reports. They will still be coming out regularly. And beyond that, I don't know. I mean, presumably there will be something. I don't want to sound like I'm burying Green Ronin. Right. You know, we're not folding up the tent. We're not going away. They just haven't bothered to tell me.
Okay, well, Mr. McLaughlin, let me ask you then. All right. After all this, looking back at, you know, everything you've done before, mm-hmm. What's your next dream project? If you could write anything you wanted to write, what would you write?
Well, you know, the thing that I've enjoyed more than anything else, you know, seemingly like the great balance between like not having to stress over it and still being happy with my results is I've always loved getting to design villains, and I would just love them to say, all right, could you crank out a book with, you know, 60, 70 new villains in it? Oh, yes, sir. I could definitely do that. So I just love to get turned loose on an all villains project, something like that. That I would just adore to do. Oh, yeah. Love that.
You know, I was just talking to John Gibbons, one of our favorite writers at Vigilance Press, and he would love mm-hmm. to illustrate a book like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen some of his art. He'd actually, you should check out Homefront Heroes. Steve Perrin wrote it. He's got a bunch of his art in there, but he's got a very painterly style, and he'd love to draw a book like that.
Oh, wow.
So maybe we can talk after the podcast if you're up to it.
Oh, okay.
So, Jason, you said you had some more questions for Chris?
Oh, well, I was curious about the noir thing mostly, but...
Okay.
But no, honestly, these I just loved all these books. I have to admit that, but you know, before I knew that we were going to do this podcast, I hadn't really sort of put it together that the same guy wrote all those books, because I'm such a consumer, you know. I just open the book and I use it, and I don't even look at the names.
My role at Green Ronin is I'm the guy who tells people when Steve Kenson's due back at the booth. So I mean, I'm used to this.
But they really are wonderful, and I use so much of them. I never ran an M&M game set in Freedom City.
Mm-hmm.
I always took the books and I lifted everything out of them and dropped them into whatever campaign setting I was using at the time. I did that Escape from Alcatraz M&M adventure. I don't know if you ever saw it. It was the first PDF adventure for second edition. And it's an 85-page like mega adventure that turns Alcatraz into a supervillain prison. And
oh, neat.
It's got like about 20 villains in it, and then a full complete maps of the prison and all of the tech stuff for it. And then all the staff and all the weapons, all the vehicles and all that good stuff. And then it creates this adventure where a villain whose name is Prince Primeval, it's about to be executed for murder in the prison, and so his surrogate daughter breaks in to break him out, and of course, in the process of all great supervillain prison breakout stories, basically blows the prison open and all the villains riot. And I wrote it as this kind of a way to sort of start off a new campaign, because second edition had just come out, mm-hmm. and in fact it was originally written for first edition and I had to convert it at the last second.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed writing it, but I sort of tried to write it with the idea of kind of what I was talking to you about, which is, you know, like, okay, it's all sort of one big toolbox, you know, and you can pull out whatever's in it and use it whatever game you're running. And even if you don't use the plot, you still have all the villains. And if you don't use the villains, you still have the equipment and the NPCs. And if you don't use them, you still have the prison itself that might become a setting. And that's what I ended up doing with all of your books, is like I took them apart sort of, you know, in the mental X-Acto knife and spread them all out and mix them all up. And we got a lot of great play out of it.
Well, that's great. I mean, honestly, you know, we've always tried to make them as, you know, our stuff as modular and as adaptable as possible, and that's great that you were able to do that. I mean, I think we've taken it to a whole new level with third edition in Emerald City, but it's great that's great. I love hearing stuff like that about the stuff we do with Freedom.
What do you think about the third edition changeover? I mean, are you pretty happy with how the rule set all shook out?
Well, I am a gamer, so, you know, when I first saw it, you know, it's like waving across in front of a vampire. Ooh, change! No, go away, change! And I maintained a degree of skepticism about, you know, just and nothing logical. Like I said, it was just sheer old gamer contrariness. I wound up working. The first thing I got to do with it was work on the DC books.
Yeah,
and I don't know why I chose to start with this. I chose to start with the new Freedom Fighters. It was like the least amount of actual supporting material for any of the characters I had to work on.
Yeah.
And I start off with the new Phantom Lady and trying to deal with the fact that, you know, she can like beat people a couple of galaxies away.
How are her powers? And I haven't read the new Freedom Fighters book. What does she do exactly?
She has a couple of armbands that she's able to open up gaps in dimensions.
Okay.
So yeah, you know, like, you know, she can open up a black hole and like bounce your character a couple of galaxies away if she needs to, like I was saying.
So powers that you never let players have, in other words.
Not without spending a hero point.
Okay,
all right. But still, in all, you know, and honestly, it wasn't until I you know, just take it, try. I was trying to do things second edition and then convert them over, essentially, in my mind.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I just started fresh from third edition and saw, oh my gosh, it's so easy now. The light bulb went off.
Yeah.
You know, and it just how much more easy and adaptable it is to do weird things with this new system. And honestly, as a guy who drew most of the weird Silver Age villains, you know, I was singing third edition's praises early on. And, you know, as I would see online at people that hadn't seen the whole rule set as they were going through their change period, I'm like, guys, I mean, you people have not had this stat up Dr. T.O. Morrow. You know, when you people have had, you know, you people try that with second edition and then try it with third, and then you tell me which is the superior rule set, because I've been there.
Right. Right. Well, that kind of, you know, in the trenches, seeing what works is the ultimate test of if the new edition is a success or not, right? I mean, you can't argue with it's just easier to make characters now. That's a tough argument to counter.
Well, it's certainly easier to make weird characters, and this is coming from a guy that designed every single all 26 trick tops that Barry Allen's arch enemy, the Top, used during his entire villainous career. I know of what I speak.
Hey, Chris, can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
After which numbered top did you get a drink?
Okay, all right. Here's where my wife just walked by the computer and goes, "You need serious help." Yeah. I did all 26 tops, research and everything, in like this manic 2-hour session. No food, no drink, just the sheer Silver Age fan gleam in my eye of I am making the top and I'm doing all his tops for all the Top fans out there. And my all too sensible and level headed wife, she was like, "And that would be who exactly?"
In point of fact, my very first Flash story was a Top story.
Oh, there you go.
Remember it clearly.
Oh, good man.
The Flash got like super aged. So he was getting older, and he faked Top out by pretending to super evolve into like. Super Brainiac Flash. You remember this issue?
I do indeed.
I couldn't even tell you what the cover looked like, but that's the only Flash, because I didn't really read DC before Crisis was over.
It's a split cover. On one side, the Top is saying, "I'm ready. I won't fight you till I'm ready, Flash." And he's chucking the Top at him. And then the second half of the cover, the Flash is an old man, and the Top then goes, "Now I'm ready."
Nice. Nice. Was that Carmen Infantino?
Oh, it had to be. It had to be. If not, it should have been.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because I all that Silver Age, DC Silver Age stuff that, you know, that nourished you through your, you know, your youth,
Yes.
I was reading Marvel all that time. You know, I grew up with Spidey Super Stories and you know, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah.
With Easy Reader on the cover. Morgan Freeman back when he was young. With a stamp on the cover saying, "Easy Reader says this book's easy to read."
And we were all, of course, looking at him going, "And someday that will be America's most distinguished actor."
Yeah, exactly. He'll be the president, and he'll tell us that a meteor is going to hit the Earth. but I came to DC with Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a good place to start.
Well, you know, I had been out of comics for a couple of years. I don't know, Chris, if any of you guys had this experience, but at some point your parents decide that you're too old to be reading comics. And so my dad made me sell my entire comics collection for like $20 or something. And so I went for a few years without them, and I was visiting my grandfather in a little town that he lived in, and there was a picture of Dark Knight Returns in this newspaper, and I thought to myself, now what comic book in the world could have gotten onto the front page of a newspaper? And I went and found the comic store and Dark Knight Returns.
Wasn't it great back before Frank Miller went crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, there were some good times before he just lost it completely.
Yeah. There were some really good times.
I actually got thrown out of a comic store in Tucson, Arizona. Charlie's Comics. Charlie's a great guy. If you're listening, Charlie, I love you. But Dark Knight Strikes Back had just come out. Oh, and I said, you know, the last couple issues of Sin City, I think Frank was kind of losing it. And now, I think this is pointless. This is utterly pointless. And Charlie wanted to argue with me about how this was a great continuation of the story. And, we got pretty heated.
And he threw you out.
He felt strongly about Batman. But, it was a thing.
Comic fandom broken.
He apologized the next day.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. All's well.
But, what happened to Frank Miller? Because he used to be so great. And then all of a sudden, wow, he's writing Dark Knight Strikes Back.
9/11 happened.
You think that was it?
Well, he's talked in interviews about how he now, to be fair, he was already drawing Dark Knight Strikes Back when 9/11 happened. He was drawing the pages where a plane hits the World Trade Center.
Oh, wow.
When 9/11 happened, and he had to decide whether or not he was going to leave those pages in the book or take them out. And he decided to leave them in. But he has since spoken in interviews about how, you know, 9/11 made it clear to him, and I'm talking about his viewpoint now, not mine. I need to make clear that I disavow this perception of the universe. And that we are in a cultural war, and it's them or us. And so that's pretty much informed all of his books since then. His next project is Holy Terror, which was going to be a Batman story. It was going to be called Holy Terror Batman, in which Batman hunts down Osama bin Laden. And that's now funny for two reasons. But first reason why it was funny is because DC wouldn't let him do it. And so he was going to do – he decided to make it a new character called the Terror, who was going to hunt down Osama bin Laden. And now it's funny for a whole other reason.
And Donald Trump wants to see the death certificate. Ba-dum-bum. Quick comics question. And this is, speaking of utterly pointless, what do we think about Superman's citizenship plotline? Is that just silly?
I think both super people's birth certificate plotlines have been utterly retarded, but that's me. I think in reality, the argument is stupid because we have a CIA and we have a Supreme Court. And we have a lot of people who would have tanked this guy well before his name was on any ballot.
Are you talking about the president now or Superman?
Both. Okay. First of all, Superman hasn't tried to run for president, and he probably can't – I don't know. He could get local office. I mean, if Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to be governor of California, I guess Superman can set his political sights as high as the gubernatorialship of any state. But beyond that, who cares where Superman comes from? He identifies himself as American, you know? It's like Michael J. Fox. Who's more American than Michael J. Fox? Well, me, because I'm an American, and he's Canadian. But he's the all-American boy. I mean, in the 80s, you know?
Yeah.
It's the same thing. If they identify themselves as American once they move to America, they're American. I think it's funny to point out that. But wait, that's different for Superman.
Yeah,
he's an actual alien.
Well, apparently this is basically a media constructed story.
Oh, sure.
In Action 900, Superman disavows his U.S. citizenship. He says he's no longer going to be a U.S. citizen. And his reason for doing this is that he says he's tired of his actions being construed as the U.S. government. So if Superman flies in and he stops some criminal in another country, everybody complains because it's the United States interfering in the internal politics of this country. And he says, well, I don't want that to happen anymore, so I'm not going to be a U.S. citizen anymore. If you read the story, it's not even very long. It's like 8 pages right. long.
Well, not only that, but it isn't his new or it wasn't his new Fortress of Solitude in like South America.
You know, I don't know.
In the current series, he's slowly becoming the character from Irredeemable.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm no longer an American citizen. I act beyond all of you. I'm tired of you ants bugging me as God.
Yeah, yeah.
It's getting a little weird.
He's not being written very well, let's be frank.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it just the whole thing is just so silly and regrettable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in a strange sort of way, it sort of reminded me of, I don't know if any of you guys read Valerie D'Orazio's blog about her time working at DC, especially during Identity Crisis.
Yeah, that was hard to read, man. That was,
you know,
that was rough.
And in all honesty, you know, when I first read over the details of the story, the first thing that popped into my mind was the story she tells about the day that the editors were going, like, we've got our rape pages. You know, it really does seem like a bunch of kids throwing a tantrum in a really pathetic attempt to draw some attention. I mean, on the one hand, it's just so desperate and pathetic a cry for attention. If you look at DC sales, I think the evidence is there that that's pretty much what it is. But it's just such a low stakes thing.
You know,
there's no other reason to do this other than a desperate cry for help. And it's just such a ridiculous part of the Superman mythology to try. I mean, it's honestly, I mean, this is like, you know, okay, how can we get Glenn back to pop a blood vessel tonight?
It's just
so badly written. And I tell you something, I just got through reading Captain America 200, written, drawn, and edited by Jack Kirby.
Yep.
And honestly, if at any time that somebody would have been justified in writing a story about why you don't want to be associated with the U.S. government anymore, it would have been then. But, yeah. You know, it has this really kind of sweet ending of Captain America having beaten the crap out of a bunch of an insane mega patriots and saying, that's not what this country is about. And let me tell you why I'm proud to be Captain America. But, you know, rather than take this 900th issue than trying to do something like semi-life-affirming or semi-positive, you know, it's this pathetic try, like, ooh, we're so naughty and transgressive. Here's your shocker. The U.S. government is evil and mean. All right. Well, here you go. Let me do my critique of that. Yeah. Well, we've never seen that before, have we? So I despise it, but not for the reasons that DC wants me to despise it. I refuse to play their game.
Well, okay, so I gotta jump in here, Chris.
Go ahead.
In all fairness, I from what I can understand from DC's reaction to Fox News, they didn't think anybody was gonna notice or care. They've been kind of flat-footed by the whole reaction. And they've been kind of backpedaling and soft-pedaling the whole thing. They haven't been trying to like seize the attention. They didn't make a big press release play out of it. They seem very much reminded me of what happened when suddenly somebody noticed that Batwoman was gay. And DC was like, holy shit, people are paying attention to comic books. Let's bury her for 2 years.
Well, and, you know, like I said, having read the, hey, the rape pages are here,
I refuse
to believe that DC doesn't know, isn't doing this from a very calculated point of view. And if there's any shock at all, it's simply because the company's got so big that you do have the occasional left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing.
Right. Yeah. But Chris, you know, I've read a lot of those reviews of Identity Crisis. A lot of people's problem with that essentially was the victimization of women, and DC has a huge problem with that. I just wonder if that the rape pages we're in isn't, in fact, an exaggeration. I mean, I don't think that was ever on a memo. No, well, no the company.
Have you read Ms. DeRozio's blog?
No, I haven't. No,
she was working there at the time.
Honestly, I don't. Please don't think I'm being rude here, but honestly, you should read her version of events before you comment on it.
Okay,
because
it wasn't
on a memo. According to her, it was an editorial meeting about how they felt like they were losing sales to Marvel and they needed something to show that they weren't, you know, they
right.
were grown up comics.
Okay,
now.
Well, now that
they,
I can't
they needed,
see happening.
They needed yeah. something cheap and shock value, and the part yeah. that you know if it happened. It's just really, truly sickening was that there was an editor who was going around with this huge grin on his face, going into everybody in the DC offices, going, "The rape pages are here."
Yeah, you know that. I mean, that I could see as a situation that would make me leave too. I honestly think that is definitely a I will leave and I will talk about this because it's ridiculous.
You would think 52 might have convinced him that wasn't the way to go. Because, you know, that was a weekly series by some great writers, great plot line. I mean, it was the opposite of shock value. It was just –
yeah, it was really good build, you know. I mean, just the Animal Man stuff in space. Like, I would read a series about Animal Man trying to get back to his family from space.
You know, honestly,
you have to remember Dan Didio, and I don't want to sound like I'm singling him out, but you have to remember this is the guy who says that Countdown was, quote-unquote, 52 done right.
Yeah, that's not true, though. That's, in fact, the opposite of the truth.
Yes.
That is what we call anti-truth on the fourth world.
Yes. And while you know, DeRozio never actually names any of the people that did any of this stuff. You know, Identity Crisis happened under Didio's watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, hey, Thor movie. What do we think?
Woo! Can't wait. Destroyer armor is awesome.
I find students for homework.
Awesome. You're a good teacher.
Yeah, I love your life, Jason. I love your life.
We're going to go see it on Saturday. I invited all my students to come meet me at the local movie theater. Well, it happens to fit really well with what we're talking about because my class is broken up into basically two-week segments. And the next 2 weeks, we're going to be talking about the superhero and friendship. And Thor has got nothing if he doesn't have the most wonderful supporting cast. You know,
yes.
The Warriors 3 and Sif and Baldur and even his relationship with his brother and the father and all of that stuff. You know, he's a great example of
– And what's great about this movie so far is that the trailers have not shown the Warriors 3 or any of the Asgard stuff. That's all going to be a surprise when you get in the theater. It's gonna blow people out of the back of the theater. From every report I've heard early from people who've been able to see it at these little like – peak events that these people have gone to, they said, "Oh man, it's the same feeling they had coming out of the first Spider-Man movie." They're like, "Wow, they really did that as well as it could be done for the film." Yeah. And I said, "Well, that's Kenneth Branagh. You know, he can direct a movie. You know, everything I've seen from him, I've liked." But
Walt Simonson compendium arrived in the mail yesterday. I don't know if you've seen this, but it's his complete run on Thor recolored.
Wow. Digitally or just
– It's all been – yeah, it's all been digitally recolored. And it's about 5 years worth of comics. It's the size of an enormous phone book. You could kill a man with this thing. I can't tell you how much it cost me, but you can look it up on Amazon. I can't wait to dig into it because those are just some of the best comics ever written.
Chris, you got any thoughts on Thor?
Well, I'll just ones that probably get you hate mail, and I don't.
you didn't like him?
Well, Thor's never been one of my favorite characters, but I'm just so over this the idea of the superhero movie. That's just, I mean, it's just another variety of modern cinema, which is basically just Baby Einstein for adults. It's just to sit there for 2 hours and look at the pretty colors.
Baby Einstein. You have to tell me what you mean by that. I'm out of touch.
It was a big seller for most of the previous years until it was all revealed to be a total fraud. But it was these DVDs of like bright, pretty colors you would show to your toddler, and the people who made them claimed that it would make your baby smarter. But at best, it was just basically your kid would stare at the TV for a few hours, so you wouldn't actually have to interact with your own spawn for a couple hours.
But Chris, didn't you see that movie Baby Geniuses? That's clearly proof that worked. Well, I mean, everything in movies is real. I don't know what your problem is.
I stand corrected.
So, Chris, what was the last superhero movie you liked?
Dark Knight Returns, because it I'm still thinking comics here. Dark Knight, because Dark Knight is a great movie that just happens to have a superhero in it. And Marvel has so far passed the idea of, hey, let's make a great movie and then just happen to put a superhero in. I mean, Thor is just a loss leader for this Avengers movie. If there was any thought or care put into it, I would be, other than on the special effects, I'd be very surprised. And
I stand on Kenneth Branagh, man. The guy's all class as far as story goes. And from what I understand, Kenneth Branagh in there with Anthony Hopkins.
But is this Kenneth Branagh on Anthony Hopkins that, you know, need a new wing put on their house? Or, you know, hey, how many zeros are on that check?
From what I understand, Branagh really petitioned to be the guy on this movie. He wanted to do like a Nordic tale. And from what I understand,
be on that check.
I don't know. I don't know if his blood, sweat, and tears went into this, or if it was just another paycheck. But the things I'm getting back are it's a really good version of Thor on film.
Well, so, Chris, you should go into the film with an open mind at least.
Yeah. Well, when you crack open that DVD in 8 months.
My wife will probably get it at some point. But I just there has yet, with the exception of the first two X-Men movies, two Spider-Man movies. There's been so little thought into putting into like making these movies about anything, and really that's kind of a stretch with the first two Spider-Man movies, which are great. They're great representations of the character, but they're just not about much. Dark Knight is truly, it's one of the best films made, period, in the last 10 years.
It just happens
to have a superhero in it.
I thought that the last Hulk movie was surprisingly thoughtful. I thought you might like that.
It was okay, but it was meant to be the exact opposite of the Ang Lee movie, it wasn't a great film by any stretch of the imagination, but I appreciated the fact that here was a guy making his vision and then trying to put a superhero into it, because that would excite me far more than let's tell people who this is so they'll go see him in Avengers.
Right?
Did really, you see that Watchmen?
I did, and I happen to
like what that guy went for, because it was like – that's like pointing to the outfield at Wrigley Field and swinging as hard as you can. And he doesn't make it, but it's like, you know, man, I see what you're doing. And, yeah, everyone who told you that it couldn't be put on film was right. But on the other hand, I enjoyed it for the – because I'm a fan of the book. I was like, wow, I see what's going on here.
Here's the thing for me about me and Watchmen. Snyder got – absolutely everything right about that film except the point. And I can tell you the precise scene where he loses me on it.
Sure.
You see, because one of the great things about Alan Moore's story is it shows you just some of the more unpleasant aspects of what it would be like to be in a world with superheroes. And part of it is the violence. The violence in Watchmen is disturbing, like violence ought to be.
Right.
When Zack Snyder goes into the slow motion beatdown during the alley fight and does the close-ups of the punches, where we're all supposed to go, oh, cool. Guy got beat up. Right there. There's a guy who completely does not get what Watchmen is about.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is what the Vigilance Press podcast gives you. Nobody else gives you Chris McLaughlin doing Beavis the way we do.
That's right. Represent.
Thank you. Normally, you have to be a high school student to hear that.
I see your point on that, Chris, and I think you have a valid point there. I agree. I do like some aspects of the film, but the idea that he is glorifying violence instead of showing its horrifying corruption, I entirely agree.
I think, there were just moments.
He just loses – and there are moments in there he just loses me as a filmmaker. Like I was watching it with some friends of mine on – I didn't measure it, but it's like an 800-inch screen. We had speakers the size of my classroom.
Yeah.
And it was like the perfect venue to watch any film. And we were getting to that heartbreaking scene in the comic where Dr. Manhattan splits with his girlfriend, the one who later – I can't think of her name, but she later turns up and she's got cancer and she's accusing him of killing her.
Janie,
thank you. And I just turned to everybody and I said, hey, what do you want to bet that Snyder goes all slow motion and close up when she throws the earrings at him? Boom! boom, it happens. We had to pause the movie for 15 minutes while we all fell out of our chairs laughing.
Right, I mean, but in the book, those earrings falling to the ground is slowed down. Like there are like five or six panels where that is. Like again, he took on the job of trying to translate the time, which is so hard to do, the motion of time in a book to the motion of time in film. And I give him credit for trying. I don't think he succeeded, but I give him credit for trying to do the things that what's the name of the guy who did Understanding Comics?
Scott McCloud.
Scott McCloud does an awesome thing about the passage of time in a comic, and that scene with the earrings in the comic does that very thing. It slows it down because that's how Dr. Manhattan views time. The problem is Zack Snyder is so big of a fan of the slow motion button on his editing machine that gets lost in every other time he's pressed the slow
motion. And he does it. He does it in such a look what I learned how to do in film school way.
I agree there too. I agree there too. It's like I think he slows it down to mimic the when you linger over panels in a comic. Sometimes in that movie, especially, like I can see when he's doing it just to do it. And believe me, Malin Ackerman, I'm sorry if you're listening to the podcast, and if you are, what the hell are you doing listening to this podcast? But don't be in movies anymore, especially with superheroes or anything that requires you to act because you suck.
Who is and he?
Malin Ackerman is the woman. Okay. Here's the scene that makes me hate that movie. Like the part that I go, why did I know she looks like the lady? But that's it. That's all she had going for her at the very end when Night Owl turns back to talk to Ozymandias. He says, you know, this makes us all criminals. Da, da, da. He's going to that little speech, and she turns around and whips her hair like it's a commercial for shampoo. And I'm like, that makes me want to throw up, and I do not like her. And every line of hers was tinny. It was like very tin-eared. All of her dialogue was said in this kind of flat way that she didn't care to be in this movie other than, wow, this movie's going to probably make a lot of money. I'm going to get launched for this.
And she's too young for the part.
That too.
Mike, every time we come on here and we talk about something superhero-related, everybody says they hate it.
I don't hate the movie. Trust me. There are great things in that movie. Rorschach, the casting of Rorschach, perfect.
We have to get together some time and talk about something that we like.
Well, you know, something I like is that Justice League International is getting greenlit.
Really?
Apparently, that little thing that Judd Winnick was doing was so successful, they're going to have a regular recurring Justice League International book written by Giffen and DeMatteis.
Judd Winnick, man. Another reality show winner. I love it. Seriously, you know, man, that guy was on The Real World, unless anyone forget.
I remember.
I was like, wow, he really wants to be a comic book artist in New York. That's amazing. And then following his life since then, I'm like, wow, that's awesome. He's gotten to do everything he's wanted to do. That's really cool.
You know, Barry Ween, I think, was his best work. I'm not a big fan of his comic book stuff, but he managed to get Justice League International, which I think was some of the best stuff from the Iron Age. And made it popular again, and now Giffen and DeMatteis are going to be writing it. And that's going to be another book with Blue Beetle. Jaime
Reyes? Oh, awesome.
So, I'm real happy about that. Snappy dialogue. It's a fun book. It's funny.
Keith Giffen, by the way.
I think it's kind of the lightheartedness, you know. Well, Chris, did you ever read that series back in the day?
Because
if you didn't, I think you would enjoy it.
I read bits and pieces of it. It's just not for me. I really just despise that whole era of comics.
I have to side with Chris on this one. I was never a fan of the Bwahaha era.
Okay. Well, you know, I was a big fan of the Bwahaha era.
You know, I mean, okay, I will give them credit for you know, being a book that wasn't trying to ape Image. And, you know, honestly, you know, if you were trying to do that back then, it's like I may not want to go with you, but, you know, God be with you on your journey because you're heading to a holy place. It's just – it wasn't my thing.
A wholly profitable place.
All right, guys. We've hit my time limit. I'm going to have to sneak out.
All right. Anything else we want to talk about before we call it a podcast?
Okay, things I like. Jason Tondreau's Field Guide to Superheroes. I really do like those. I really do like those.
Wait till we do the villain version. We should do that next.
Yahoo!
Field Guide to Supervillains.
Sweet.
I didn't know you guys were going to do it. Sounds like Chris wants a supervillain book too. Maybe we should pool our efforts.
Villain books are like monster books. I can't believe there are more of them.
Yeah, you'd think there would be something for icons for villains.
Yeah.
Oh wait, there is.
There is
Villainomicon, and I love that book too.
Yeah, I pimped that book enough on this podcast. I had like three or four pre-release.
It actually is in print now, which is awesome. It should be
out.
Congratulations.
It's a great book. You should buy it. It was it took as long to build as some pyramids in Egypt, but it's out.
Using the same amount of slave labor, I have to add.
Mr. McLaughlin, any closing thoughts?
Wow, I was on such a good tear there talking about things I hate. How about this? Here's a great positive ending. Okay, all right. If you've bought anything that I ever wrote or had anything to do with and you enjoyed it, thank you very much. I don't get to say that often enough. Even if you have no idea who I am, you know, especially if you bought Noir and enjoyed it, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And honestly, I would really like to thank all of you individually if I could. So please shoot me an email so I can thank you in person. And I mean that. Honestly, thank you.
What a Gen Con. He's super nice.
Thank you.
All right, Dan, anything you want to say before we cancel or close out?
Yes, I forgot to mention Noble Knight this week. Noble Knight just finished a huge sale, but they always have great deals. I think right now we're just adding a new line of these Polish miniatures, and it sounds weird to mention Polish miniatures, but it's a line of fantasy miniatures by Micro Art Studios. They're just amazing looking. They're all resin. They're not metal, but they are pretty cool. They'll probably be on the site within the next week or so. Check them out.
Excellent. That's NobleKnight.com. They're our friends. Be nice to them.
Yes.
Give them your money. All right. Hey, folks, thanks again. And until next time, stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant.